Recording now.
Perfect. Hello, everyone. My name is Dave Keller. I'm the Chief Market Strategist at StockCharts.com. And Dave, thanks so much for the invitation. Really interesting conference and a couple speakers that I know and respect. So I'm glad you were able to put 2 days of really good content together and certainly excited to be a part of it. I'm the Chief Market Strategist at StockCharts. We're based outside of Seattle, Washington in Redmond. So as with now most of the country, we're in lockdown mode, but have been in lockdown for, I think this is our fifth week. So getting comfortable with things. As with everything I feel like I've done in the last couple of weeks, thanks everyone for being patient with all the technology, internet kind of issues we're facing here. Here's a standard disclaimer saying, please don't do anything with anything I'm about to tell you. So what I wanted to do with our time together is do a presentation that I designed called How to Beat the Bear Using Relative Strength. And when I was learning about this conference and sort of what sort of discussions were going to be made, you know, when I thought about what systems, what tools that traders should be using that I feel like they're not using enough of, for me, relative strength always comes up. And what that is the concept of comparing stocks that you're trading, stocks you're looking at relative to other stocks. And I have found, especially with shorter term timeframes, people don't tend to, I think, focus enough on that. And as a result, you end up doing great analysis, but your returns are not as good as they could be because you're just not looking at the right charts in the first place. So what we're going to do today is talk about sort of three things. Number one, I just want to share with you my sort of investment philosophy, and it's really built on behavioral investing, behavioral finance, behavioral thinking, and just thinking about how you think as an investor. In the second part, we're going to talk in particular about relative strength, what it is as a tool and how to apply it. And I'm going to share with you the three ways that I've found relative strength can help you become a better investor, a better trader, and just be more optimized in terms of how you're executing on the names you're looking at. And then in the final part, I'll just share a brief market outlook, what I'm seeing. Obviously there, you know, we're in this, you know, hopefully what I would consider a bottoming process, but that I think will take quite a bit of time. And so I'll share with you some of the charts that I'm looking at that help me draw that conclusion. So I hope that sounds like a good time, good way to spend a little under an hour together, and I'll do my best to keep it entertaining. For the first chart though, I want to show you just a brief background for me and hopefully why I've earned the right to speak with you today. So my background comes in a couple different pieces. I actually started in the industry in mid-2000, and it was at Bloomberg in New York City. And so my introduction to investing, and to be honest, the time that I learned technical analysis and charting and how to analyze the markets really happened during this secular bear market, a cyclical bear within a secular bear. And we had things like 9/11 and all of that happened, the tech bubble bursting, all happened in the first year or two of my experience analyzing stocks. And I would say that was a formative period for a lot of reasons, but I've always had more of a focus on risk than opportunity as a technician. And I think the reason is because that's how I learned it. Coming into the market, all I heard were stories of euphoria where people are buying a new Rolex because they had a good day yesterday, and tech stocks just go up with no down days. And that's kind of how investing is. And I got a day tech account at some point along here, and it was absolutely brutal with the reality, the call to reality that everyone sort of went through together. So for me, I think that first couple years was certainly a challenge. Then in mid-2008, I was hired by Fidelity up in Boston to run their technical research team. And over time, I ran a couple other groups as well, but that was my main role. And so mid-2000, moved up to Boston and was there for about 8.5 years through the end of 2016. So right about here, I was a little concerned with the cyclical nature of my job changes, which had happened about every eight and a half years, and cyclical bear markets. So I felt really good a couple years ago when I felt like finally that trend has changed. And when I launched my own firm called Sierra Alpha Research a couple years ago, I felt like finally I have broken this horrible pattern of destruction every time I go to change jobs. Bad news for all of us on the webinar right now, though, is because I just joined StockCharts about six months ago, last fall. And now I'm recognizing once again a return to cyclical bear patterns. So good news for all of you, the Dave Keller Premium Research Package, I will let you know ahead of time when I'm considering a job change, and then you'll be able to get ahead of things maybe a little bit. I say that purely in jest. I'm pretty happy what I'm doing right about now. Along the way there, and in the middle of this one, if you're not familiar with that, is the CMT Association, which was called the Market Technicians Association. I was on the board for about 9 years, and I served as president from 2010 to 2014. So if you've looked at the CMT exams, you're familiar with that designation. That's something I earned back here as I was learning technical analysis. And even if you're not a professional analyst, I'd certainly recommend that for the CMT, just for the disciplined process of learning technical analysis and data visualization. I think it's really helpful. awful. So that is my work history in chart format, just to give you a sense of where I'm at. And again, for me, if you'll notice, all of my, you know, especially as I was learning technical analysis, I always learned to have more of a focus on risk than reward. It gets me to my first main section here, talking about just my investment philosophy. Again, I had the very traditional background of studying music and psychology as an undergrad. So when I came into the markets, and so I joined Bloomberg really knowing very little about equities or the Fed or bond math or any of those wonderful things I've now learned. But Bloomberg did a really good job of hiring about 50% liberal arts majors like me and 50% finance and econ majors. And at the end of 6 weeks of a very focused training together, the finance and econ guys helped me understand what stocks were and what the Fed was and how to calculate bond yields and all that kind of stuff. And I helped them ask better questions and listen and be better at presenting and speaking. And so in the end, we all came out a little more well-rounded, being able to talk more intelligibly about the financial markets. So my background in psychology has really driven me to focus on investor psychology and on behavior. And for me, I have decided many years ago that my role as an analyst, as a strategist, is to get inside the collective head of all the other investors and try to understand what's motivating them. And when I learned technical analysis, I was taught that the markets were driven by fear and greed, fear on the downside and greed on the upside. And I think at certain periods in U.S. history, that's certainly been the case. But I would argue now that the markets are driven 100% by fear. And on the upside, it's the FOMO, it's the fear of missing out. On the downside, it's fear of losing everything. And so it's all fear, at this point. And you recognize now that we're in a period of exaggerated volatility, how the fear can manifest itself in just the day-to-day movements of equity and asset prices. But so we have to remember that humans are emotional beings. And as much as trading, especially if you have a shorter term time frame, as much as trading has been automated and algorithmic trading and high frequency trading and just hedge funds in general all have changed the dynamics in the short term, at the end of the day, I would argue that those models that they might be using are still modeled on, they're trying to model human behavior. So it's not getting away from human behavior. I would argue it's even exaggerating it even more. Humans are emotional. And the trick, to be honest with you, is to take advantage of the fact that others are fearful and acting irrationally and do everything you can to minimize the impact of those emotions and act as rationally as possible that you can for your own investment strategy. Now, how do you do that? So I want to share with you a paradigm I developed called the mindless investor and the mindful investor. And again, even if you're a long-term investor thinking about retiring years down the road, or you're a short-term investor just dealing with the next couple minutes, I think this is the same. And when I talk about past and present and future, that could be any different time frame, right? It's all about what is relevant to you. So don't think that I'm talking about a particular time frame here. I think it's relatively agnostic to that. So I think a mindless investor basically has an unhealthy relationship with their past, their present, and their future. So you ignore the past. The past is a source of negativity because you're going to make mistakes, and all traders do, right? You're going to have a bad trade. You're going to have a bad day. You're going to have a bad month, even if not year. And so what we like to do mentally is to minimize that emotional strain on ourselves. We like to ignore the past. We move past especially painful experiences so that we can focus on the good stuff that's going to come next. But as we will learn, that you lose a great opportunity to learn from what's happened before. As a mindless investor, you also fear the future. So the future is uncertain. It always will be. We don't know what's going to happen with the next minute, with the next tick. So as a result, that's a source of anxiety. The uncertainty causes us some anxiety. Now, finally, we worry about the present because we don't learn from the past and we don't anticipate the future effectively. What's happening right now is pretty much catching us off guard. We don't have a good awareness, a good situational awareness of what's happening around us as a trader. What I would argue we need to do more of is this, which is be a more mindful investor. So I see the mindful investors having a very healthy relationship with their past, their future, and as a result, they're able to live for the present effectively. So we learn from the past. We don't use the past as something to ignore, as something to move, to get over. We use it as an opportunity to learn. And now more than ever, where you're going to have days where the market just completely crushes you, that's a great opportunity to learn, to upgrade your toolkit, to upgrade your mindset, upgrade your processes. These are learning opportunities. When I think back of that chart of my market history, I see a bunch of down moves, which were, I would argue, my biggest learning experiences. I didn't learn a ton in 2004 when everything was just kind of going up. I learned a ton in 2002 during a bottoming process. And I think you will find the same in this current period if you are focused on keeping good track of your thinking and how that evolves. I would also say, you know, the best investors and traders that I've worked with, and I've had the pleasure of meeting lots of really talented investors over the years, they have a good game plan. They're not just sort of trading on feel or just sort of figuring it out as they go along. They have a really clearly articulated game plan, and they have a sense of what they're going to do in different scenarios. And as a result, they don't have to worry about it. If you hear from the great money managers, they're not talking about the uncertainty and they're just not sure what's going to happen. And oh no, it's like, this could happen, this could happen, this is what I'm going to do, done. And they just have, they focus on developing that good plan. They don't worry about what might happen. And because you learn from your past and you have a good plan for your future, you are then able to live for the present. And I have, you know, learned meditation and mindful practices over the years. And I was actually taught at the workplace when I worked at Fidelity, they had this great foresight of bringing in a mindfulness expert that spent 6 weeks with a group of us, about 30 of us from the asset management division. And we went through a 6-week training course on mindfulness meditation. We did different meditation styles. We had daily homework that we had to follow. We had to keep a journal of all of our different experiences. And as a result, we all came out, at least for me, it was transformative. And it helped me to respect what was happening around me and not have that be a source of anxiety. So I think a mindful investor has the ability to observe what's happening around them and not have that be a source of stress, but have it be a source of information, a source of enlightenment. And we're going to talk over the course of the presentation here some of the ways that I think you can do that in your own trading. So if you think about it, all those things that I just mentioned in terms of, you know, the past, the present, and the future, they all rely on one really key thing, which is self-awareness. And when I think of some of the investors that I've gotten to know, and it's guys like Peter Lynch at Fidelity, it's, you know, Steve Cohen and others that I've been able to meet and talk with. It's got Jay Woods from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, one of the executive floor governors. I just spoke to him this morning. And when I talk to them, they have a really good idea of who they are and what they're trying to accomplish. The junior investor, the amateur traders that are not there yet, that seem very green in their process, don't have a great self-awareness. They don't have a really clear sense of who they are, what they're trying to do, what their strengths are, and even most importantly, what their weaknesses are. There's a reason why all 12-step programs, if you're familiar with any of those, the step one is always something involving admitting that you have a problem, recognizing that you're imperfect, that you need help. Because until you can do that, that is the first step. Because until you can do that, nothing else is really going to work. You don't have the chance of really meaningfully improving what you're doing without that. And so I think as an investor, as a trader, you need to make sure that you have mechanisms in place to encourage you to have a deeper self-awareness. You should know what your strengths are. Where do you really have the opportunity to outperform the other traders that are trying to do the same thing you are? What can you do that's better? Then you also have to recognize what your weaknesses are. Where are the opportunities that others could be taking advantage of you? And what systems, what processes, what people are you going to surround yourself with to make sure that you minimize the impact of those weaknesses? So for me, I tend to be very disorganized. Naturally, I'm more of an idea, pie in the sky, head in the clouds type of person. And so I've worked really hard to be more organized by having a really good planner system so that I know what I need to do when and I can prioritize. I also have an assistant that keeps me on track and is way more organized than I will ever be. And I even married an accountant who is a very organized, beautiful woman. And as a result, my life has become much better organized because I found ways to address those weaknesses. And I would encourage you to think of that same thing. Spend some time later today, this weekend, and make a list of what you perceive as your strengths and really have an honest conversation where your weaknesses are in your process, in your own mindset, and then start to think about how you can address some of those. What I want to do now very quickly is go through each of those, the past, the present, and future, and share with you just one quick idea for each one of those that how hopefully you can upgrade your own relationship with those timeframes. So the first thing is learning from the past. And what you'll find if you follow any of my work, and I host the Closing Bell Show on Stock Charts TV called The Final Bar. It's on our website every day and on our YouTube channel. You'll hear that I have a lot of comparisons to aviation. And I'm a student pilot. I've not figured out a way to spend enough time to complete my pilot's training, but I spent years as a student pilot enjoying the process of learning flying. And the first couple flights I had with my first flight instructor, we ended up talking a lot when we were going around midair about markets, because when he wasn't teaching people to fly planes, he was on the ground day trading in his stock account. And so we would compare notes. When he learned what I did, we would just talk stocks as we were flying around. And we very quickly found all those parallels between flying and investing or flying and trading. And so I'll share with you here with the past, present, and future, some of the lessons from aviation that I found has made me a better trader. So this is a moment of levity as I'm flying around over Rhode Island, I want to say years ago, taking a quick selfie. And then I was, of course, immediately after this moment, very focused on situational awareness, making sure I was acting appropriately. So how do we learn from the past? Well, a couple ideas. Well, number one, I would say it's a post-mortem analysis. And I don't know about you, but if you know Latin, post-mortem means after death. And that basically, if you've ever worked with anyone in the technology space, at the end of a big project, they'll do what's called a post-mortem meeting. And what that means is what went well, they'll review the performance of the team and everything during that project. What went well, what went poorly, what do we need to improve on for next time? And And it's so funny, as traders, how rarely do we spend enough time doing that, really having an honest look back at your performance, and especially focusing on some of the challenging stretches that you went through. So two ways you can address this. Number one, when I ran a team of professional stock analysts, we would do what we call the worst call meeting. So twice a year, we would all get in a room, and the price of admission was you had to bring a piece of paper, printed out a chart of your worst call for the last 6 months. And it was an incredibly humbling experience. We all did it. And it was tough because we basically had to walk into a room and admit some bonehead mistake that you most likely made over the last 6 months. You had to do it twice a year. So a couple things happened once we started instituting this meeting. Number one, I found that everyone's performance started to improve a little bit. I don't know if that was market related or this meeting related, but I speculate that no one wanted to come in and admit an ultimate horrible, painful mistake that was so obviously incorrect, right? It's okay to have a bad stretch and have some bad calls, but you didn't really want to do something really stupid. So I think people were on their best behavior trying to avoid having to own up to it. But the second thing is it was very meaningful because you got to see how others in the group were all facing similar challenges. We all had bad decisions at some point, and learning from each other's mistakes was really informative. So question number one for you, how are you tracking your performance, tracking your thinking? How are you keeping a good trading journal? That's step one. A lot of people stop there, unfortunately. When do you schedule in your calendar a time to look back to the last month, the last quarter, the last 6 months, whatever, and go through and focus on some of the trades that did not go well and think about what were the conditions there? What can you learn from it? What can you do differently? That is point number one. I really hope that you take away from this. The second thing is to look at missed opportunities. And I think in this environment, especially, it's very easy to get the blinders on, think, all right, we're in a bear market phase. Most things are going down. Stocks are getting killed on average. Breadth is very weak. You know, everything's kind of struggling, but there are always stocks that are going up. There are things like Regeneron that are at or near new highs, even in a difficult phase. So there are stocks out there that are diverging from the broad market. So what I like to do at the end of a period, so end of every year, I've always done this, where you look back for the previous year, and you could do this for the week, the month, whatever time frame is meaningful to you, and you look at what stocks in your universe or whatever your universe is, if it's futures or currencies or ETFs, look at all the things you could have potentially traded and look at how they did over that time period. And I make a list. So if I'm thinking of the S&P 500 as my universe, what are the five top stocks there? Were I in those names? And if not, what did I miss that prevented me from getting an AMD or KLAC to semiconductors that in 2019 absolutely crushed it, or Target or Chipotle? Also, what were the stocks that really did the worst? Or what were the ETFs that did the worst in my universe? And did I own any of those, and why, right? What did I miss that could have gotten me out of those trades? So if you're a short-term trader, that's totally fine. Use a compressed time frame at the end of every week. Make that part of your weekly routine on a Friday or on a Saturday. Go back at the week, look at how things did over that time period, and look at where you were. Where are you at relative to the best and worst opportunities? And what can you learn from some of those places where you were not there? And what could have been in your toolkit that could have encouraged you to make a better buy and sell decision in some of those names? So now that we've hopefully used some of those to get a better sense of the past, how do we have a better situational awareness? And the name of my own firm is called Sierra Alpha Research, and that's slang for situational awareness, which is a pilot term, basically meaning you have an awareness of what's going on inside the cockpit and outside the cockpit. So I learned to fly on a Cessna 172R, and the slide you see in front of you is sort of the dashboard of that plane. It's pretty classic sort of dials with all the information that you need, along with the avionics on the right there. Pretty simplistic, but the idea is by looking down at all those instruments, you can get a sense of where the plane is and where you need to be going. And then also, and more importantly even, you need to be looking outside through the glass and see what's around you. And as a quick story, the way I learned this very painfully and hopefully not, or gladly not that painfully, was my first night flight. So you have to have a couple hours of night flying, which is a little disorienting because you have the stars out on a clear night. It's hard to see the horizon, and it presents some challenges, and the communications can be very different. And so the first flight, I'm sitting there, and my flight instructor says, okay, look around. You see anything that, you know, is kind of concerning? And I'm like, look around. I'm like, no, I don't think so. I think everything's fine. And he's like, all right, you sure around 10:30, 11 o'clock, you sure something's not kind of important there? So now I'm just sweating a little bit, thinking, all right, what am I missing? I kind of glance sort of, straightforward to the left a little bit around 10:30, 11 o'clock. And sure enough, I see these lights kind of looking like they're getting bigger. And I say, actually, it looks like another plane. And he said, yep, that's a plane. We're on a collision course right now. So one of you has to diverge. And there's we were kind of in the middle of nowhere, so there's no way to really communicate. communicate with them. So my instructor just pushed forward on the yoke, put us down about 500 feet very quickly. The other plane never changed course. They just kind of kept flying right where they were. So had we not diverted, to be honest, it's actually very difficult to run into another plane in midair, but we would have come way too close for comfort. And so it was a great lesson. It was a reminder. What I had been doing is I was so caught up in the map on my kneeboard. I was trying to pay attention to navigation and the communication, talking to the, giving the right radio communication, that I wasn't paying attention to where I was and who was around me, some potential issues. This is why, you know, most aviation accidents, most flight problems happen because of pilot error, human error. And it's things like running out of fuel, running into clouds, the mountains, something like that. And your flight ends prematurely, unfortunately. So you are taught to have a great situational awareness. How much is it, though, and how often have you found in your own process that you feel like you don't have a good situational awareness for the markets? And I find a lot of times traders get the blinders on. They're focused on the particular chart or the particular price, the particular stock that they are trading, and they forget that that is one particular price among millions of prices that are fluctuating at any given moment, right? You are one piece among a huge piece of the puzzle. So having an awareness of what's going on around you is actually really important. So the way that I've learned to develop a good situational awareness is by having really good routines. And I will tell you, better routines will most likely lead to better results. It's not one-on-one. It's not like if you spend 1 hour more a week on your process that your returns will improve exactly the same way. But I will tell you, you are much more likely to be in a position to find success if you have better routines. And that's why I think they're really important. So on stockcharts.com, where obviously I use the platform very regularly, you know, working there, I have a list of chart packs of chart lists that I go through every morning. I call it my morning coffee routine. And first thing in the morning, once I journal and get ready and everything, I come up to my office, I light up these lists of charts, and I start at the top and I go to the bottom. And this process, following it every day religiously, has helped me, I feel, become much better equipped to understand what's happening. And when things move, you can immediately go back to that moment. And it also primes you for what you need to be focused on. It's very easy to get caught up in the flickering ticks, the news headlines, and all of that. So before I look at news and see what coronavirus headlines are popping up today or what the Fed might be doing, I look at these charts and I think about, what is the long-term trend? What are the short-term movements? How do they relate to the long-term trend? And then at the end, after all of this, is when I start looking at news and seeing what's happening intraday. So those of you that do use stock charts, if you go to your login, just click on your dashboard, there's a little button that says manage chart packs. If you look at your chart lists and you actually see the DK morning coffee routine or something like that, you can actually get this list on your own login. You're welcome to use it, tweak it. I would encourage you to develop your own routines, but by all means, please start with mine if you don't have a good sense of where you want to start. So now that we have a better situational awareness, we now need to talk about the future. How do you plan for the unforeseen issues that can come at you while you're trading? So this is actually when I was on one of my long solo flights. I was flying around sort of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, back to the Boston area where I was hangaring the plane. And this is actually probably hard to see, but it's just Providence, Rhode Island here. That's downtown Providence. So off the right wingtip, I could see Providence. Can't really see Cape Cod, but it kind of goes out that way. And then Boston's way over here to the left. And so this was coming back to my home airport. Had a great view of Rhode Island from the air. Now, while I was enjoying the view and looking at the harbor and enjoying the fact that the ocean was very pretty that day, I also had a sense of what I needed to do in case of emergency. So I knew that off my left wingtip, there was North Central Airport, which is sort of northwest of downtown Providence. And so I knew, given my altitude and how far I was staying relative to the airport, if the engine cut out right at that moment, I knew that I had enough time and I had a game plan in mind to get and land at this runway very easily. Given the wind, I knew right where I needed to go. So as you're flying around, you're always thinking of your backup plan. You always have an exit strategy in mind. As investors, we need to do that so much better than I feel I've seen some people do. You know, the reaction when the market completely crushes you, when you are, you know, long the SDS, double short S&P, and the market rips to the upside, there's an emotional, you know, your palms start sweating. It's a similar feeling to when you run into trouble in midair. And so you have a physical and emotional reaction to that. The goal is obviously to get away from that. So as a pilot, here's what you do. Instead, you know, the first time you're flying in midair, and I'll never forget, my instructor yanked out the throttle, my palms start sweating, the whole plane goes down, your heart goes in your throat. And he says, all right, you just lost your engine. What do you do? And they do that to teach you what it's going to feel like and to be comfortable with what that feeling is, that sensation of falling and what the plane does, how it looks, how it feels, how it sounds, and then get you really comfortable with using the checklist of these five steps. And there are others I'm sort of glossing over here, but this is generally the process that you follow in an emergency situation. If your engine cuts out in midair, you set airspeed for maximum glide, meaning you give yourself as much time and space as possible to land the airplane safely. The next three steps are just trying to make sure you're getting as much fuel as possible from the wings. The two wings is where you store the fuel in that kind of plane. And then finally, you check the ignition, maybe your knee knocked the key out or something, which would kill the engine. So one of those five steps usually will fix the problem and you'll recover and be able to keep flying. But if not, you again have an exit strategy. You have a plane, an airport that you know you can land at safely. So as investors, you need to have the same kind of thing. And the point of this checklist is that it's not an emotional decision anymore. So 3 months later, when he pulled the throttle out and said, all right, you just lost your engine, I'm kind of yawning. I'm like, okay, airspeed, fuel travel, mixture rich, fuel stock value. I kind of just knew those steps without even looking. And it wasn't an emotional reaction anymore. It was a very disciplined, rational reaction to, I'm flying an airplane and the engine cut out. I need to get it back going. Here's what I do. As a trader, you need to have that same emotionless reaction to adverse circumstances. So this is what my technical checklist looks like. And again, you are welcome to use this as a starting point of your own. I hope you have your own. And if not, point number one for you then, I hope you spend some time later today, this weekend, sketching out your own decision tree using technical analysis. What steps do you follow to make a good decision on a particular chart? This is mine, and it's evolved over many years. I've taught technical analysis at college level outside of Boston at Brandeis University. And so these are the steps that I follow. Number one is Dow theory. Is this chart in an uptrend or downtrend? That's it. Question number two, are we, what are any clear trend lines doing? Where are we at? Are we breaking out, breaking down from any of those? Where are we at relative to key moving averages, and are they sloping upwards or downwards? Any specific chart patterns that I recognize, breakouts, breakdowns, any support or resistance levels at play that I want to pay attention to? Then I have a question called confirmation, which is basically any technical indicator, volume, anything that would help validate what I've seen on these first five steps looking at price. And then the seventh one, which is where we're going to go next, is relative strength. And as an equity investor, I would argue, regardless of your time frame, you should be looking at the relative strength, which is how that stock is performing relative to other stocks that you could be looking at. For me, once I've answered those seven questions, then I have earned the right to make a buy or sell decision, or I've earned the right to say I am bullish or bearish on a particular chart. So often in the course of the trading day, you will find that you skip over some of these on purpose or just without thinking about it, because you just sort of, the answer seems so obvious, you just kind of go with it. And I would encourage you as strongly as possible, especially in this environment, do not just quote unquote go with it. Have a disciplined list of steps that you follow as a way of answering the questions to validate whether or not you should be taking that position. The more you stick to that, the more you are going to be less driven by emotions and more driven by discipline, which I would hope is maybe one of your main takeaways from my presentation today. So that, you have now gotten my sort of investment philosophy. This is how I approach the day from a mental, from a psychological, from a trading perspective. That's how I try to win. Let me talk to you now about how I use relative strength. And again, my goal with this conversation is to introduce you, if you're not familiar, to relative strength. If you are, maybe just tweak some of the ways that you might be using it. I'll help you understand how I use it to pick stocks. So point number one, relative strength here in this case is not RSI. Those are two different things. So here I'm looking at the daily price chart of Electronic Arts for the last year. I then have the RSI, the relative strength index, and then I have the relative strength of Electronic Arts versus the S&P 500. And that is what we were talking about, this bottom panel, looking at a stock relative to its industry, its sector, the broad market, whatever, looking relative to another stock. So a moment on RSI. RSI is very important to me. Most of my charts look pretty much like this. They are super simple, but they include these two inputs as well as moving averages and the other things that you saw in my checklist. RSI, I think, is incredibly important because it standardizes the price movements and it bases it on momentum, and it helps you identify when a market could be overextended because buyers or sellers have become too aggressive. So don't take away from this that I do not find RSI very important. I do. I use it all the time. So if you watch my show, you'll see me refer to it very often because I think it's incredibly important. But there are two different ones. And Wells Wilder created this. If you have his book that he wrote in the 1970s, he created RSI and parabolic systems and DMI, the ADX line, all of those he sort of unveiled in this book. I think it's the naming is so unfortunate because it's relative strength index, meaning the movement of the stock relative to its normal movement, I guess, is how I would interpret it. But it would be better named like internal strength or something like that. So it's a bit of a misnomer. It's not relative to anything else except the price of the owned stock over the previous time. Here's where we're looking at the bottom panel. Tom Boley, who's one of my fellow stock charts contributors, does a really good job using relative strength. He shared a quote years ago, which I love to refer to, and he said, if you want to outperform the S&P 500, you need to own stocks that are outperforming the S&P 500, which seems very intuitive as I'm saying it, but it's so funny how often we expect to outperform a passive investment strategy, but not owning stocks that are outperforming, right? That can't work. The math does not work out. So unless you own stocks or assets that are outperforming the S&P 500, then you're better off just owning the spiders or something like that, and just going away and relaxing and not worrying about the trading day. So relative strength tells you whether or not you are getting it done as an investor, as a trader. So this is a chart of Intel. What I like about this chart right now is the fact that if you look at the last 10 months, the stock has been in a pretty consistent relative uptrend with notable changes. So for example, February to mid-March, it underperformed because it sold off way worse than the average stock did. But since then, you can see since the second week in March, it's actually been a pretty nice relative outperformer, outperforming the S&P by about 13-14% just in the last couple of weeks. So a really decent move coming out of the lows. So recognizing that that's the case, recognizing that the stock is appreciating more than the average, more than the benchmark you're looking against is incredibly important. So the goal as a trader, as an investor, should be to own stocks where this relative strength line is going up. And if you own stocks where the line is going down, you need to be revisiting your process. Now, I will tell you three functions that I see of relative strength. And function number one is as a scorecard. As I alluded to, relative strength tells you whether or not you are getting it done. Again, owning stocks where the relative strength is improving tells you are successfully outperforming a passive investment process. The problem is this though, when your portfolio looks like this, and this is the XLK in the first week in February, and you can see the relative strength line was consistently going higher. Even during the market volatility since then, this relative strength line overall has continued to appreciate. So it's been, tech has worked in bull and bear phases now recently. But if you look at that relative line going up, when your portfolio looks like this, we tend to attribute that performance to our skill as investors, our skill as traders. I am doing well because my process is so awesome. When your portfolio looks more like energy did the first week in February and the relative strength line is going down, we tend to not attribute that underperformance to our skill or our lack of skill. We attribute it to other circumstances, extenuating circumstances. The market just went against me. It was just a bad day, bad luck. So we attribute our successes to our skill. We attribute our weaker stretches as bad luck. And what I would encourage you to do is treat all of this as a reflection on your discipline and your process. Because if you own things that are doing this, you are missing something along the way based just purely on the signal embedded in the relative strength. The fact that this is underperforming means there are better opportunities out there that are left untouched by you. So you are not getting it done as an investor, as a trader, if you ride relative move down. Again, regardless of your time frame, if you're looking during the day, if you own things and your positions are getting crushed and you don't have a good exit strategy, you are not getting it done process-wise. And so think of both of these as a reflection on your process and your discipline. That's how you're going to improve yourself. The second function of relative strength is as a technical indicator. So I will tell you that relative strength is a scorecard. It tells you whether or not you're getting it done, but it also has value for your process. And I will tell you this, relative strength is a great way to manage risk. So I'm going to share with you a behavioral bias called the endowment effect or the endowment phenomenon. If you're not familiar with this, this is an example with a coffee cup from earlier this week. I took this picture of this with my phone in my home office here. And this is a coffee mug that I got a couple years ago. Let's say that you had this coffee mug. Doesn't mean much to you because you don't really know maybe what the Walden School is. You're like, it's as good a coffee mug as any. Maybe it's a coffee mug you found in the office with everyone else, but is it that important? No. So if it broke or you got rid of it, it wouldn't really matter that much. For me though, this is a very special mug because I bought it at a music conference for composers and arrangers that I was invited to a couple years ago. I went up in the mountains of New Hampshire and composed music for a week, and it was an amazing experience. It was unforgettable. And I bought this mug to remind myself of that great creative release that I had. So for me, this mug is incredibly important. It's so valuable. So one mug that costs maybe a dollar or two to make has different values for the two of us just because of the emotional connection to it. I have now introduced you to the phenomenon of the endowment effect and why stocks that you own, a lot of times we treat them like our Walden School mug. And when the stock goes down, when the position is going against us, when we're starting to get hurt, when it's underperforming, we treat it like that coffee mug. It's so special. How can we imagine getting rid of that mug? I love that mug. I love Disney. This has been such a great stock for me. It's been one of my top performers, even though the price is going down and it's breaking through moving averages and it's breaking through support levels and it's going down. The RSI is down in the bearish range. It's not getting above 60. I still love this stock. And the problem is you own it as it's getting absolutely crushed on a relative basis. So other stocks are holding up better. Other stocks are going to new highs into February, and you're owning a stock that's actually going down during that same period. So the endowment effect is actually very powerful. And what it does is it's what prevents you a lot of times from selling a position that's not working anymore because you have an emotional connection, whether or not you realize it, to that stock or to that position. You don't want to believe that the position is hurting you. What you need to do, obviously, is have more of an evidence-based process. You need to focus focus on the statistics, focus on the data, focus on what signal you can derive from the charts and use that as your decision-making process. So there are plenty of ways along the line here, the bearish divergence at the peak in November, the fact that it was making lower lows as many stocks were making higher highs, the fact that it broke down through the moving averages, which then started sloping downwards, the fact that it broke down through support. I have just listed out four or five specific technical reasons why you could or should have sold your Disney position before it completely cratered into mid-March. And I would say relative strength is a great one, right? So right about here going into year end, you could tell that the stock was not performing as better as well as other stocks you could potentially be looking at. So that down move in relative strength tells you, should be a signal. If you look at your current holdings, look at that relative strength line, it tells you which positions you may want to be rethinking. And if not, you better have a good technical evidence-based reason why you want to continue to hold it as it's going down. Now, another way you can use it as a technical indicator is using relative strength as a way to measure performance and a way to identify opportunities. So at StockCharts, we have a tool called the StockCharts Technical Rating, SCTR, what we call the Scooter Rankings. And what this basically is a percentile ranking. So I'm showing you the top 10 stocks as of yesterday's close. It's sorted by the Scooter Ranking. So again, it goes from 1 up to 100. And so the number one stock on our list as of yesterday was Regeneron. Now, if you go to our website, you'll see what goes into this. It's a pretty classic momentum-based sort of trend-following system. It's, you know, in order of trend strength. So the higher the number, the stronger the trend. And it is a mix of long-term and short-term trends. And so these are the stocks on a relative basis that are getting it done. These are the top 10 names based on that methodology, that trend-following methodology. And it's a relative measure because it's a percentile ranking. So it forces stocks into the best down to the worst. So if you look, here are the themes, and this is why I think this basket is going to do pretty well here going forward. You have things like healthcare and the biotech names. As you could guess, I mentioned Regeneron, which arguably is one of the better charts anywhere. You have the work from home names like Citrix Systems. You have semiconductors like Nvidia keeping all of our devices and hopefully live streams and Zoom rooms working effectively. You also have Kroger and Netflix and other things we might be using. So it's not surprising that these are the names at the top of the list. These are not the same names that were at the top of the list a month ago, right? So it changes based on the movement. So looking at a list like this and seeing which stocks are stronger or weaker relative to everything else is really important. The third function now of relative strength, I would argue, is a market barometer. Using relative strength can tell you where there's opportunity because it gives you a sense of the broader market environment. So a couple charts that I would use as a way to measure the market environment using relative strength. Number one is the relative outperformance of technology. And I mentioned that earlier. It has been a consistent outperformer. And when a sector like this has outperformed in bull cycles, like it did here in most of 2019, but also in bear cycles. So as the market's selling off, people were still sticking with the big technology names. The relative strength overall has been fantastic. So regardless of what you think could happen to the market, I want to be owning sectors, or I want to be thinking about sectors where the relative strength is strong and consistently strong, and tech better than anyone has been able to do that. So I think the resilience of technology as leadership is a persistent theme that I would argue will probably most likely continue for the foreseeable future. But if and when that changes, that tells you the market regime is really dramatically changing. And so for me, seeing if there's a breakdown in relative strength, a breakdown in some of the more defensive sectors like utilities, for example, could be very telling. We've not seen it yet. Second example is looking at the relative strength of consumer discretionary versus consumer staples. So at the top, I'm doing the ratio of the XLY, which is the consumer discretionary ETF, versus the XLP, which is consumer staples. Now, the problem with that ratio, or just so you know, consumer discretionary, that ETF has a huge overweight in Amazon. It's probably over 25% of the ETF at this point. So Amazon doing well or poorly is going to dramatically skew that ratio. So in the bottom series, we actually have the equal weighted ratios. This is equal weighted consumer discretionary, equal weighted consumer staples. Now you can see that the ratio had actually broken down a lot earlier than the cap weighted one. And even though the bounce out of the March lows was really driven by the resilience of Amazon, on average, it's still been favoring staples over consumer discretionary, suggesting that institutions are leaning more toward the defensive side of consumer still. And finally, you know, when you think as a trader, the relative performance of small caps versus large caps has been a huge theme. And when you think about that, when you think about the underperformance of financials recently, these are not recent phenomena. So small cap stocks have been underperforming large caps for a while. It's been very much a large cap, mega cap driven market, even through last year, really since the market low in 2018, if not earlier. So small caps have not been a great place to be. So as you're looking for opportunities, the chips are stacked against you if you're looking in the small cap space, because on average, those are not not really doing well. It's been more driven by the mega cap trade, the FANG trade, the big cap tech, consumer, communication services types of stocks. And even with the bounce that we saw out of the lows, even with the return now to more of a bearish sentiment today, we're still getting underperformance from small caps. So until that line starts to turn higher in a meaningful way, we put in a higher low, start to show some improvement. I think as a trader, you really want to be looking at where the opportunities are, where the outperformance is. And small cap has not been the place and doesn't seem to be in the near future. So that's my breakdown of relative strength. And again, three ways you'd use it: as a technical indicator, as a scorecard, but also as a market barometer to get a sense of what's happening. Given that, I want to wrap up my presentation, just giving you a quick market outlook, just what I'm seeing, some of the charts. Some of these are very longer term charts. And I would argue, I've found working with traders over my career, they don't spend enough time. Some of you may not spend enough time looking at longer term charts. I think there's a lot to learn from the big picture orientation, because it's going to help you be better equipped to understand the biases that are driving long-term investors. And whether or not you are a long-term investor, if you're very short-term, the big trades that are really going to move things are driven on long-term themes more often than not. That's what the Fidelities of the world are trading off. It's not the short-term stuff. It's the really long-term, cyclical, secular trend. So understanding those as a trader, I would argue, is really, really important. So the first market outlook chart is actually really old. This is going back to 1929 to 1932, sort of the middle portion of this chart. And the reason why I'm showing you this is bear market rallies can be absolutely brutal. So the first sell-off that we saw in 1929, the rally that came afterwards retraced almost 50% of that sell-off. So we sold off dramatically, but then we had this huge rally, and you have to believe that that sucked a lot of investors in during that period. But if you look, that bear market rally was similar to all these other upticks, which at the time probably felt a lot like a bottom. It felt like buyers were coming in. It felt like an alleviation of downward pressure. It felt like finally the last seller has sold. Now we're going to go higher. And then we go back down again. More recently after 9/11, we saw that bounce after the markets reopened. And I remember that period because I was learning about investing then. And then we broke down below the 2001 lows and went to new lows again. I remember the thought was, oh my God, we might be going to zero. This might be the end. So bear markets can be painful, and they can be a long term. And I would caution you, just be wary that bear market rallies can be sudden, they can be severe, but they don't last. And that's the real differentiator. So when you hear people talking about dead cat bounces, which is a phrase I've thrown around in the last week or two a couple times, that is what it feels like: a huge sell-off, a bit of a recovery before the next leg down. It's sort of a way to stabilize, to reset before the further bearish sentiment sort of evolves. So two quotes I will share with you. And if you don't know these guys, you should look them up. Bob Farrell ran the Merrill Lynch technical research team in like the 70s, 80s, 90s, if I remember right. His quote was, at the bottom, stocks will be cheap and no one will care. And the problem is, I've still, as the market sold off 20, 30%, I heard a lot of investors and arguably some younger investors saying, all right, great, now we're getting in. This is the bottom. This is the time. And to be honest with you, when you're that excited about buying stocks, that probably means the bottom's not in place yet. Bear markets bottom with a whimper. They bottom when you cannot imagine buying stocks. And that gets me to my second quote: when the time comes to buy, you won't want to. And this is a quote from Walter Diemer, and it's the punchline to a great story. Basically said, and this is around the 1974 low, which if you don't know your market history, look back to the 1973 to 75 period, which was a really tough bear market, secular bear market phase, and a tough market bottom as the market went to new lows in 1974, and people were really skeptical. He said a money manager, he was at Putnam in Boston at the time, it was in the 1970s, and portfolio manager came in the room in his chart room and said, all right, stocks are down big. Is it time to buy yet? And Walter said, nope. And the guy left. And the next day comes in, he says, all right, we're down another 5%. Is it time yet? And Walter says, nope. So the third day he comes back in, he says, all right, now it's got to be, we're down even more. It's got to be the time now. And Walter says, nope. And the portfolio manager says, well, what the heck? When are you going to be telling me to buy? At some point it's time to buy. And Walter said, well, when the time comes to buy, you won't ask me anymore. And so that's the thing, right? I feel a lot of negativity. I feel a lot of fear, a lot of bearishness, but I don't feel yet, anecdotally, the capitulation of people not wanting to buy stocks yet. I still see anxious buyers willing to come in, and that's what tells me we might see further downside. Now, the more evidence-oriented way that I would tell that, I have a long-term trend following model that I've followed forever. And again, if you're a short-term trader, this is a time frame beyond what you will probably ever think of, but you should, because again, this is how long-term investors are going to orient themselves, and that's the playground you're going to be playing in if you're trading during the day. This is based on the 21 and 34 week exponential moving averages, and the crossovers up and down are what tell me the long-term trend is positive or negative. It does not trigger very often. The last time it triggered was the market sell-off in December of 2018. It just triggered 2 weeks ago, finally acknowledging the trend was down. Now, there's a short term, more tactical read that some of you will probably be more interested in. This is a weekly PPO, which is essentially a MACD, just a little different calculation, but very, very similar. If you know the MACD, it's the same idea. And that actually turned negative second week in February, suggesting the tactical trend was down, suggesting more risk off, more risk aversion. This long-term signal just validates the fact that we are certainly in bear market territory. So sometimes in shorter bear market moves, that's actually been near the bottom. But again, based on the extremes that I'm seeing on all the other models and also the breadth, I don't think we're near the bottoming. The bottoming process is not done yet. Now, looking at the daily chart, one of the questions we just asked our viewers on Stock Charts TV is, what do you think we'll see next, 2,800 or 2,300, and which way we would break? And we also asked, at the end of the second quarter, end of June, will we still be in this range? Will we be above 2,800, below 2,300? You know, gun to my head, what do I think? I actually think we'll be below 2,300 because I think the bottoming process is going to be evolving. I wouldn't be surprised if we're back within this range, but I could not imagine a scenario where above 2,800 at that point. And again, that could happen. I could definitely be wrong. And the goal of technical analysis is not to guess where the markets are going to be. So I'm paying more attention to the price. And what I did see is a bullish divergence, which is certainly short-term bullish. I've seen some short-term bullish signals, like a bullish engulfing pattern yesterday, which if we remain above 2,450 would validate that as a potential short-term buy signal. But I'm concerned with the fact that we're approaching really significant resistance right around 2,650. This is the first Fibonacci retracement level of that last most recent big sell-off from February to March. It also is right where we topped out last week. And so again, that 2650 level would be huge to eclipse. So until we break above that, I think the bias is still aiming lower. The way I can tell that that's the case from my perspective is the breadth picture, right? And so there are a number of ways to measure breadth. This is the cumulative advanced decline lines for the S&P 500, for the New York Stock Exchange, for the mid-cap index, and for the small-cap index. And basically, as long as these continue to be in a downward trend, I'm going to be more skeptical of any sort of bull market, bullish days or short-term moves. If we could establish a higher low in the advanced decline line, which potentially we're doing this week, I don't know yet. We'll have to see how it finishes out. If that would be the case, I think that would be actually kind of compelling, but it's not happened yet. And until then, we are still making lower highs and lower lows in breadth. And that tells me to lean more negative than positive. Next is looking at the percent of stocks above their 200-day and above their 50-day. And I will tell you, working with some junior traders, people just getting comfortable with technical analysis, and that's where I've coached people over the years at times. You know, I find when things really get bottomed out, you get really excited because you find something's oversold and you think that means I need to be buying. I need to buy oversold and sell, buy oversold, sell overbought. And sometimes you're absolutely right. But the problem is during real deep bear market phases, indicators like this can become very depressed and stay very depressed for quite a while. So a lot of people, you know, when you saw this get below 20%, that's where we were when the market bottomed out in 2015 and 16. That's where we were when it bottomed out in 2011. It's about where we were in 2010. That's where we were at the market bottom in 2018. Perfect. There's my buying signal. But if you're only looking at the last 5 or 6 years, which I think, unfortunately, a lot of younger investors, that's sort of your time frame. That's where you've learned. Bear markets look very differently and they feel very differently. So you need to be going back and take a history lesson from 2008 to 2009. Look back at the 87 low. Look back at the 2001 to 2002 period and look at some of the conditions there. If you look at the percent of stocks above their 200-day moving average on the S&P, you'll see it actually went below 10% here, which was right in October of 2008. That was 6 months before the eventual bottom. That was the first initial sell-off, which is why I would argue we're sort of in that this point. We're at the early stages of the bottoming process. We're not at the ultimate bottom yet. And so this indicator, this breadth measure can stay depressed for months. And that's what we saw here in 2008. It finally broke back above 10% in April of 2009 after the market had actually bottomed out. And that's what signaled that bearish sentiment was alleviated. So we've not seen that yet. And again, I found a lot of people, their playbook is based on the last 5 years or so. You need to be going back to historical bear market phases to see what those actually look like. And I think we're looking a little too much like 2008, 2009 for me to think that that was it, that we've established the bottom. Finally, my last chart for you today is looking at a very long-term view of the S&P 500. This is not for a trading signal, but just to show you a great market lesson. There's one thing I have learned over my career and working with a lot of really talented investors over history is that all bear markets have indeed been followed by bull markets. So at some point, I am certain we will reclaim the previous highs in the S&P. I don't think that's going to be tomorrow. I don't think it's going to be in the next couple months, but it'll happen at some point. So if your runway is long enough, if your time frame is long enough, I think you have lots of good, compelling, viable opportunities around this area. But if you're more short-term or tactical, I would remind you, if you zoom out far enough, the 1974 low or the 1987 crash or the 1982 pullback all seem relatively mild, but living through those was probably probably a relatively harrowing experience. And I think that's where we're at right now. So to finish on a word of positive outlook, all bear market phases have indeed been followed by bull markets. It will come. You just need to figure out how to get from here to there. I hope you'd enjoy this presentation. My goal is just to introduce relative strength, talk about my philosophy, then just share with you what I'm seeing, looking at the charts that I work with every day. This presentation, I actually posted it on my website this morning. So if you go to marketmisbehavior.com/techwizards2020, you can download a PDF of this presentation. I encourage you to check out my blog and other resources that I have available to you. I love to think about how we think as investors. You'll find a lot of videos and blog content related to that. And then finally, as I mentioned, I host the Closing Bell Show, The Final Bar. Usually I have a really good studio shot, but given where we're all at physically, this is where I'm broadcasting from, the home office in Western Washington. And we're all doing the best we can, I know, to navigate this environment, given the restrictions. So listen, it was a pleasure to be with you. Thanks again, David and team, for inviting me to present. I hope you all found this helpful. I look forward to hearing from you through my website, through StockCharts, and then on Twitter at DKellerCMT. And thanks again, everyone.